There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the House of Cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today. In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to Strange Planet. On this episode, we're going to explore our emergence as self-aware members of a planetary home and entire universe that is unified and innately sentient entity. Dr. Jude Kurovan is a cosmologist, futurist, planetary healer, member of the Evolutionary Leaders Circle, and previously one of the most senior businesswomen in the United Kingdom. She has a master's degree in physics from Oxford University and a doctorate in archaeology from the University of Reading. She's traveled extensively, worked with wisdom keepers from many traditions, and is a lifelong researcher into the nature of reality. She's the author of 6 books, including The Cosmic Hologram and her latest, The Story of Gaia, The Big Breath and the Evolutionary Journey of Our Conscious Planet. Dr. Kurovan, welcome. How are you?
Richard, thank you for inviting me. I'm very well, thank you. And I'm very cognizant that this is Thanksgiving Day in the US. So for all the folks that are with us, either now or later, happy Thanksgiving.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm actually in Canada.
I'd understood that.
We celebrate our Thanksgiving in October. But of course, many of my listeners are American, so we wish them a happy Thanksgiving. Just very quickly, this is kind of a sidebar, but I'm fascinated by sort of the underlying lattices of coincidence that exist in our reality. And the other night I was watching on YouTube a special with the late country singer, the coal miner's daughter, of course. And I just learned...
Loretta Lynn, I think, isn't it?
Loretta Lynn, yes, Loretta Lynn. And I just learned, reading your biography, that you are a coal miner's daughter. So there you go.
I am indeed. And my granddad, too, was a coal miner.
Wow. So let's begin with when you were 4 years old, you had conversations with... visitations from what you call discarnate entities. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Be happy to. And I really want to put this in context, Richard, that this is not that unusual. Not as for children. You know, my research for all my life has shown how common it is for young children to have such experiences. And I was fortunate in that I didn't choose to share them with anyone, even though I know my mum would have said, okay, that's fine. I suspect the community around me would have called them imaginary friends or poo-pooed them or whatever. And yet those experiences did was open the door to a lifetime of engaging with and communicating with discarnate realms of existence and intelligence. And my life has been enriched enormously by that ongoing experiential realization that there's much more to the nature of reality than our universe, wondrous though it is. And of course, I'm by no means the first person to have such experiences. We're told stories throughout history, and I'm sure prehistory, of this, because as we'll share, I'm sure, this is our natural state of being. You know, we are microcosms of a universe that does exist and evolve as a unified entity and does so on multidimensional levels of reality. So my experiences, and I'm incredibly grateful for them, have offered me deep insights and powerful expressions and experiences of the even greater wonder of the nature of reality.
I'm just trying to imagine how those experiences would have, I don't know, played out in the coal mining community.
I can't imagine. I mean, it was weird enough that at the same time I was fascinated by astronomy, the stars. I was fascinated by quantum physics. So I gave my first lecture in quantum physics at the age of 9. And my audience were my mum's neighbours, who she invited around and bribed with her very good chocolate cake and a cup of tea. Listen to this precocious child. I don't know what I said, but clearly it was something that got a round of applause at the end.
Ultimately, that led you to Oxford University to discover physics, but then you also studied, you received your PhD in archaeology. My wife trained as an archaeologist. I always joke that's why she married me, because she likes digging up old things.
Bless. Well, it may seem they're very different in terms of their areas of expertise and study, but obviously because I was having these multi-world experiences, I was walking between worlds from a very early age and was fascinated by the stars, by quantum physics. When I was 18, I chose to go to Oxford to do a master's degree in physics and specialising in quantum physics and cosmology. And I was the first member of my family to go to university at all. So it was a very big change from what I'd grown up. And what I was finding was what I had been experiencing since I was a little girl, I was not being taught at Oxford. The leading edge science was still teaching then, and to some degree still is, although it is changing, a paradigm of materialism and separation. So although it offered me a deep insight and fascinating journey of, you know, to some degree, how our universe is as it is, it was very much not the deeper perspective that I was seeking to really understand, and which has taken me the last period of my life ever since to come to that deeper point. But after a corporate career that you kindly mentioned, I chose in the mid-90s to move beyond corporate life. And part of that, and it was only a small part of it in a sense, but I studied to do research and a PhD in archaeology. But it was anthropological archaeology. So it wasn't just about, it was about artifacts and all the more familiar archaeological studies, but it was actually researching ancient cosmologies. Cosmology is how we make meaning, how we understand our world and our place in it. So on the one hand was leading edge science to try and help us understand that. The other was ancient wisdom. And it was ancient wisdom that for me really gave me much deeper insights into what I was experiencing in the nature of reality, such as the ancient Vedic tradition of India and many of the ancient traditions and indigenous teachings were giving me a far deeper perception that correlated with what I'd been experiencing all my life. And so my PhD wanted to delve even deeper into that perspective.
So the study of the sacred sciences from our forebears, our ancestors, you've talked about how we studied the sacred sciences for millennia, and then a couple hundred years ago, we took this different path where science focused almost exclusively on our physical reality. Why did we do that?
It's a good question, but as a student of history, I think there are a number of reasons that certainly help contribute to that. The first is that in the early 1600s, you had a situation where the church was the authority on the nature of reality per se. And yet people were coming to really be curious, not just about the sort of the speculative approaches to the nature of reality, but they wanted to experiment. They wanted to actually study in a way that was data-based, that was information-based, that was experimental-based, as well as observational. But rather than speculate, they wanted to, as you said in your introduction to the show, to follow the evidence wherever it led. And so you had at the beginning of the 1600s, someone called Francis Bacon, who actually understood the entire perspective of reality from a deeply spiritual perspective, but also wanted to understand how sort of heaven and earth met, as it were, in doing experimentation and a scientific methodology to follow the possible evidence in the physical world. And so people like Isaac Newton, who came after, were natural philosophers. They didn't even call themselves scientists. They called themselves natural philosophers. But they wanted to follow that route too. And whilst hitherto the church had said no to anything that wasn't of the physical realm, these natural philosophers said, okay, well then we'll just follow where we're being led evidence-wise in the physical world. But it did start to move that sort of perception of separation between science and spirituality, or science and the deeper nature of reality that doesn't need religion as such, but does absolutely involve non-physical discarnate realms of existence. And that process continued. And whereas I think Francis Bacon, who I do greatly respect as an amazing, insightful person, wanted to sort of just offer a methodology that was replicable, in some cases he's been sort of seen as quite a villain for sort of starting this road into materialism and separation. But that, in all the readings I've ever done of his in the original writings, because the original writings were in Latin, they were then later translated into French. But when they were translated into French, all the spiritual aspects, all those deeper perceptions were excised out of them. And then when they were translated into English, they came back as this materialism rather than the initial intention. So I think that started the journey, and we're now at a point where we're at a point.
Right. And we've certainly, benefited in unimaginable ways from that focus on physical reality. Are the two, the sacred sciences and the hyper-focused sciences on physical reality, going to reconnect?
I think we are, you know, science really at its best is evidence-based. It's evidence-led. And to go follow that evidence wherever it leads. And 100 years ago, of course, we had the quantum and relativity revolutions because experiments were being done and phenomena were being discovered that were anomalous to that older paradigm of materialism and separation. But the material separate perspective had become such a predominant worldview by then, not just in science, but in our structures, organizations, our education, all of this, that the deeper clues as to this more profound understanding of reality were pushed to the side. And what continued was more and more of a technological focus on what quantum physics and relativity had uncovered. But now we're at a point where we're discovering evidence across all scales of existence and across many different fields of research that that materialist separatist paradigm can no longer hold. And so we're realizing and needing to absolutely bring into a central focus what the quantum physicists and Einstein, you know, Max Planck and Einstein and many others realized was showing us something deeper about the nature of reality. And it was beyond physicalized energy, matter, and physicalized space-time. And now we're realizing that they indeed, the appearance of our universe does indeed emerge from those deeper realms of non-physicalized causation, which is converging with the universal wisdom teachings and into a much deeper, profound, integral perspective of the nature of reality.
And what was missing, that the ephemeral quality of physical reality, of matter?
In part. I mean, we've known that the physical reality is incredibly ephemeral. When we dig down and down and down, you know, we've known for almost as long as the 20th century scientific revolution that it's 99.99% no thingness. What was really missing was the acknowledgement of the centrality and the all-pervasiveness of consciousness, of what Einstein would have referred to as cosmic mind, what, you know, different religious teachings describe as God or Allah or great mystery or great spirit. Whatever terminology we use, we're finding that indeed mind and consciousness aren't something we have. They are literally what we and the whole world are. So the whole of this emergent cosmological understanding is of a universe that exists and evolves as a unified entity, but where mind and consciousness are its all-pervasive fundamental stuff and express itself, mind and consciousness, cosmic mind and consciousness, expressing itself as the appearance of our universe, of energy, matter, space, time. But the deeper reality and the all-encompassing reality is that of mind and consciousness.
So when you say that the universe did not begin with a big bang, but a big breath, explain what you mean.
This is me being a little bit facetious, as I know you appreciate. It wasn't big. We know it was minute. It was at its tiniest form when it the first moment of space-time, you know, came into being 13.8 billion years ago. But if I was to ask you, Richard, when I say the word bang, what connotations, what comes to mind when I say bang?
Well, this has always confounded me because first there was nothing and then it exploded.
The no thingness of it is essentially a universe as a great thought emanating out of a cosmic plenum. So it's beginning, we can start to have an appreciation of. But when you say bang and explosion, we know it wasn't. We absolutely know it began in an incredibly ordered state, incredibly fine-tuned, utterly not just interrelated but unified with the laws of physics as informational, relational instructions for how it can then exist and continue to evolve. And so very much as the first moment of an ongoing big breath. So space has expanded ever since, as time has flowed ever since. Our universe is far more as a great thought, rather a great thing, but as a big breath of cosmic consciousness, which again harks back to the way in which it was described in the ancient Indian teachings as the breath of the great breath of Brahman, the creator God. So that's why I describe it thus. And for many folks, A, it's more accurate, much more accurate than the idea of an initial Big Bang and then a random series of processes ever since. But it really sets the context of our universe as innately meaningful, existing meaningfully and purposefully evolving from simplicity to complexity ever since.
Jude, we'll take a quick time out. We'll come back and continue to delve into the story of Gaia.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Welcome back. Dr. Jude Curvin stays with us. The story of Gaia, there it is, the brand new one. The big breath and the evolutionary journey of our conscious planet. Speaking about the nature of reality, the idea that our physical reality is indeed real. So what is the illusion then?
Separation. You're absolutely right, Richard. Our physical reality is real. This isn't a simulation of some advanced technological ETs, but we are grounding ourselves now in cosmic awareness, cosmic mind, cosmic consciousness, with our universe and possibly many other universes. As the eminent Edwardian scientist Sir James Jean said, more a great thought than a great thing. So in that sense, and knowing now as we do with the evidence that I write about from many, many different researchers, this isn't just me sort of coming forward with this. This is many different researchers across many fields of research are realizing that our universe does indeed exist and evolve as what's called a non-locally unified entity. And non-locality was a concept that came into perception at the time of the quantum revolution, because the quantum physicists were themselves realizing that you cannot separate an observer from what is observed, that for quantum physics to work at all, our universe has to be non-locally unified in its entirety. Within space-time, there's a cosmic speed cop, the speed of light. Nothing can go faster than that. There's no signal that can go faster than that in space-time. And that's vital, because we couldn't be having this conversation if that wasn't the case. But they also found there was an and, that for space-time as a whole, our entire universe is what's called non-locally connected. So it knows itself as an entirety in every moment. And in 2018, after researching and doing experiments that were sort of showing that such quantum locality, non-locality, was much larger than the quantum scale, we were able to show by non-locally what's called entangling photons of light in a lab, with photons of light coming down a telescope 600 light years away, and then photons of light coming from an incredibly active galactic center called a quasar, 12.2 billion light years away. Entangling those in the laboratory showed us the cosmological scale of our universal non-locality, which itself is the fundamental ability of our universe to exist and evolve as a unified entity.
In a unified, the idea of non-duality, and we are one and unified even in our consciousness. Where is the individual in all of that?
Crucial. Vital. Unity is not uniformity. Our universe, although it does exist and evolve as a non-local and unified entity, its unity is expressed in radical diversity. You know, from that very first moment of the big breath, when atoms, you know, information became accumulated and expressed as the energy matter of our universe. From that very first few moments, and the simplicity of hydrogen, and then moving to helium, and all the way through, primarily then hundreds of millions of years later in stars, this alchemy of ever greater complex elements with different attributes, and yet themselves resonant and harmonically connected and structured in such a way that they could relate with each other and take complexity even further into molecules and interstellar dust clouds, almost to the edge of biological complexity, and then the formation of planetary systems such as ours, and then even greater complexity into single-celled, multi-celled, all of this incredible abundance that we experience on our beloved planetary home, Gaia. That is our universe's unity in radical diversity. And of course, with us as self-aware beings, every one of us unique, all of us part of a human family, all of us part of an even greater community of sentience we call our planetary home, Gaia, and all of us together as part of our incredible universe and a multidimensional universe where we've hardly really begun to explore what it means if we can wake up to remember we're inseparable and consciously evolve into that, what I see as the invitation of our universe and Gaia to become co-evolutionary partners with that ongoing evolutionary impulse to evolve.
Information. Let's talk about information, because yes. You say that we should restate the laws of physics as laws of information. I want to get to that in a moment. But first of all, why do you put a hyphen in between in and formation? In hyphen formation.
And it's not because I'm obsessed with hyphens, although that might be part of it. That might be part of it. I wanted to differentiate between information can actually be gobbledygook. You know, we have an English alphabet of 26 letters, A, B, C, D, and on. Of themselves, each letter of the alphabet doesn't have any meaning. It's only when we bring them together into words and sentences and poetry and song and books and all the rest of it, we make meaning of those 26 letters of the alphabet. And our universe is not randomly gobbledygook information, even though its alphabet, its universal alphabet, is actually digitized letters, ones and zeros. We can go into that. But again, just as in our communications, our digitized technologies, we take objects, names, visuals, sounds, and we transcribe them into long columns of ones and zeros, which of themselves describe a leaf, a tree, a song, a person. And then we squirt them down cables and recombine them into that original image, object, whatever it may be. Our universe uses just two letters, ones and zeros, not like our English alphabet with 26, but from that, it meaningfully combines them. As nucleons, as atoms, as molecules, as planets, as plants, as people. So that's why I put the hyphen in, to really keep banging on about this is not meaningless information. This is not random data. We are microcosmic co-creators of a universe of innate meaning and meaningful purpose.
So the ones and zeros that you alluded to, that would be the cosmic hologram?
That would be the language of the cosmic hologram, yes, because we, coming from the study of black holes and the informational understanding of black holes, we realize that when a massive star comes to the end of its lifetime, it can't, you know, it's gone through all its fuel, its nuclear fuel, it collapses in on itself, but it's so massive that nothing can hold back that gravitational collapse, and it collapses between, and the star itself is spherical, so at the end of its life it collapses spherically and goes within what's called an event horizon, within which it continues to collapse, but nothing, not even light can escape. There's a slight smidge in that, but not even light can escape. So that event horizon surrounds a sort of an area, spherical area that is black, hence the black hole. But when we research, well, what happens to all that information within that star? We'd think intuitively, just as the information perhaps in a book, that the informational content will be proportional to the volume of the book. Yeah?
Right.
It's not. The information of a black hole is proportional to the surface area, the spherical surface area of that event horizon of the black hole. So we start to go, well, aha, what could this mean? And of course, that's what holograms do. We take a beam of light, we bounce it off a 3D, an apparently three-dimensional object. We collect the information back. We then arrayed that information on a two-dimensional patterned plate. We then beam more light through that patterning and a projection, a 3D projection of that original object is created that we call a hologram. So when we as cosmologists expanded that research, that understanding of black hole information to the whole of the universe, the holographic principle, as it's called, posits that the entire three-dimensional appearance of our universe, four-dimensional space and time, our entire four-dimensional appearance of our universe is a projection of intelligent information, cosmic consciousness, as the three-dimensional space and one-dimensional time of our universe. So a two-dimensional boundary, one of space, one of time. And that then, as our universe expands, as space expands and time flows forward, it's that boundary of the appearance of our universe, which is the hologram, the cosmic hologram, from which all that we call our physical reality is projected into its realness, but not into a separation.
We'll take another time out, Dr. Jude Kurivan. The story of Gaia stays with us.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
We're here with Dr. Jude Kurivan. There is the book, the new one, The Story of Gaia. How do we get a copy?
Richard, thank you. Any good bookseller, the publisher in the traditions or Amazon. The book's just come out in the States and Canada on Amazon and will be out in the UK and Europe on the 8th of December, but folks can pre-order it now.
So we were talking about information in hyphen formation, and you were talking about, you know, restating the laws of physics as laws of information, as algorithms. These are the instructions that enable our universe to exist and evolve. Can you give me some examples? I mean, where do we see these algorithms or this signature at play in both the man-made world and the natural physical world?
Well, certainly in terms of signature, we find that because everything is in relationship to everything else, for some time now, when research has been studying complex systems, they've realized that although they may not embody the idealized geometry of the ancient Greek geometers, that they do embody geometries, innately embody geometries, and they're called fractals. And we find them at many, many scales, from atoms to, in fact, our entire universe. In 2017, the fractal signature of the cosmic hologram, because this is a characteristic of holograms too, the fractal signature of the cosmic hologram was discovered in what's called the cosmic microwave background, which is relic radiation from the very very early epoch of our universe, and so fills the whole of space. So we find these fractal signatures all the way through, from atoms to the scale of our planetary homes, so coastlines, clouds, weather patterns, ecosystems. They pervade our collective behaviors. when analysis of the internet was done fairly early on, because now it's so vast, supercomputer on supercomputer to do it. But it was shown that the nodal points, the backbone of the internet, the way that the internet comes together, embodies exactly the same fractal patterns as does ecosystems. The way that we collectively behave does so too. And of course, because of that, internet companies, data companies, understand this and therefore use those algorithms based on these patterns to effectively predict our collective and personal, but collective behaviors. But the other side of it, when I talk about the laws of physics, there are three laws that are really fundamental to the understanding of our physical reality. And they are the laws of thermodynamics. But the laws of thermodynamics speak to energy and matter, and they speak to how systems of energy and matter embody a concept called entropy, which is the number of the microstates in such a system. By restating, as we can do, those laws of thermodynamics as laws of infodynamics, we find something very simple and very remarkable. We find that the first law of infodynamics, expanded, describes information expressed as energy matter, as quantized energy matter. So it's the simplest way we can actually describe quantum physics. And the second law of thermodynamics, when we span to infodynamics, helps us understand the description of space and time as being innately informed in a complementary way. And that gives us another insight into the law of relativity. But by doing that for those two laws of thermo to infodynamics, we can see how quantum physics and relativity physics, by treating them informationally, can be reconciled. And that's something that's been attempted for nearly 100 years. The third law, which is rather beautiful, shows that the temperature of a system, like our universe, is in inverse proportion to its informational content, which we're now redescribing the sense of entropy, the concept of entropy, as the informational content of our universe. So by going back to that first moment of the big breath, at the highest temperature our universe will be and the lowest informational content, we can see how as space has expanded and time has flowed ever since, that as the temperature's reduced, the informational content's increased. So we have a whole life cycle process for our universe that can naturally embody its journey from simplicity to complexity and ever greater levels of embodied experience and thus informational content. So it just like a Rubik's Cube, which I could never handle. This is much simpler than a Rubik's Cube. It just all comes together and we have this understanding of a meaningful, purposeful, unified, conscious universe.
I just want to go back to the idea that there is this apparent signature we see both in the man-made world and human behavior and natural ecosystems. You compared a couple of interesting studies. One was the destructive power and the frequency of earthquakes, and also how that is mirrored in the destructive power and the frequency of human conflicts.
That for me was one of the most profound ahas, and that I speak of in The Cosmic Hologram, the previous book to The Story of Gaia. Because yes, indeed, we see that when researchers were trying to understand and therefore predict earthquakes, there was a hope that there would be something that is an average earthquake that could have an equation around it that could help prediction. But when the frequency of earthquakes are graphed against the destructive power in a logarithmic scale, which we commonly know as the Richter scale, instead of a sort of a peak at an average earthquake, the distribution was along a long line, a straight line. So the only relationship between the frequency of an earthquake and its destructive power was that bigger earthquakes are less frequent. And it's about, an earthquake with twice the destructive power in logarithmic terms was four times less likely to happen. Now, there are other ways that we can sort of get a bit of a look at earthquakes, but there's no easy way other than that appreciation of that innate relationship.
They're all unique. They're individuals.
They're unique. They're exactly that. It's just more powerful ones are less likely to happen. We find exactly the same in looking at conflicts. At the end of the Second World War, there was an analysis of numerous conflicts going around back several centuries. And then more latterly, at the University of Miami, there have been studies of insurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, we see the same pattern. When we plot the frequency of conflicts against the destructive power in terms of fatalities, we see them aligned, whether it's world wars or regionals, conflicts along that same pattern. Slightly different pitch, but it's very much the same relationship. And that's because underlying the appearance of our physical world are what's called attractor basins of information. And they underpin weather patterns, they underpin complex systems, they underpin our collective behaviours. And so what we're finding is that if our collective perceptions is of a worldview of separation, then in a way, conflicts are natural outcomes. And they band within, as all our behaviours do, they band within an array of behaviours that reflect that. What we find from the whole story of the evolutionary process of Gaia is that as we move from simplicity to complexity, there are higher level attractor basins of complexity. So with us waking up to remember we're inseparable within this wondrous, intelligent, conscious, and evolutionary universe, we're actually beginning to potentize the next evolutionary attractor in our awareness, where instead of conflicts being a natural outcome of our perception of separation, then peace is a natural outcome of our perception of unity in diversity.
So as this attractor basin that we're currently existing or dealing with, let's say, what is likely to cause that to sort of fall away and allow us to create this new attractor basin?
It is falling away, isn't it? Because we've got to a point, because of that journey of a worldview of materialism and separation, you know, we've behaved accordingly with each other and with our planetary home. We've come to a point of utter unsustainability. So it is, the center cannot hold. It is falling away. And that we've seen throughout the whole story of Gaia. There's as the old has come to the end of an evolutionary arc of whatever that has meant, it has broken down. But as its breakdown, a new higher level order of complexity has come forward. And we find this an example is insect and biological metamorphosis. For a caterpillar to metamorphize into a butterfly, it moves into crisis. It moves into a crisis where it can't eat anymore. Its environment can't offer it anymore. It goes into a cocoon. And in that cocoon, it breaks down. The old literally dissolves. But in that dissolution, what's called the imaginal cells of the butterfly are starting to form. And as they do, the old is dying away. It can't sustain. It can't hold. It sort of fights against what's coming forth. But that makes the butterfly stronger. So at the end of that process, when the butterfly is ready, it breaks out of the cocoon and it flies. And instead of being a rapacious eater, and I'm not judging caterpillars, I'm really not, but instead of sort of eating everything it can in its environment, which is pretty much the way we've behaved, a butterfly is a pollinator. It spreads abundance from flower to flower, from plant to plant, in great beauty. And again, I'm not doing, great for butterflies, and isn't it awful for caterpillars? But I'm just saying that in the whole story of Gaia and Gaia as a planetary home, that journey from simplicity to complexity has been one of continuing ever greater levels of self-awareness. And those arcs into complexity have absolutely been embodied in cooperation. So Gaia collaborates. She's collaborated as a planetary home for over 4 billion years. But that collaboration sometimes can be creative tensions and competitive tensions. But whenever there's been a move to greater complexity, from single cell to multi-celled and on and on and on, throughout her entire Gaia sphere, that has always been as a result of cooperation. So I think at this point, this potential waking up to remember who we really are offers us this incredible opportunity to come together, to evolve together, and undertake this next chapter of this incredible journey of a universe, a planetary home, and us, perhaps to think of ourselves now and experience ourselves now beyond humans as Gaians. I think this is the invite that we're being called and invited to join.
So despite all of the chaos in the world right now, this, to use this butterfly analogy, is just part of our metamorphosis. And ultimately, this is kind of a hopeful time.
If we choose, yes. If we choose to stay in the illusion of separation, more and more fear, more and more fragmentation are natural outcomes of that. If we, however, do, and I believe we are doing, and more folks are doing, waking up and doing that work on an inner level as well, you know, the inner connection with the wholeness of our of all that is, as well as the outer linking up and lifting up, yes, this is an extraordinary, hopeful time. And it is our choice as to which we will choose, which direction we will choose to go.
The story of Gaia. One more time, Dr. Kurevan, how do we get a copy?
My publisher, Inner Traditions, who are an excellent publisher and have other wonderful books. Amazon.com in the US, Canada, books already available. In December the 8th, UK, Europe. Pre-order it now. Any good bookstores.
Jude, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Richard, it's been my deep and great pleasure. Thank you.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.